So this morning, I'd like to talk more about trusting heart mind. This is my third talk on trusting heart mind, and I'm going through it from the beginning to the end. So this is in your program. You see where I am. So this is where I am. Making the smallest distinction, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. If you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. To set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind. When the deep meaning of things is not understood, the mind's essential peace is disturbed to no avail. The Tao is perfect, like vast space, where nothing is lacking and nothing is in excess. So, Tao, in the sense that translated as way, is the manifestation of trusting heart mind. And trusting heart mind is essentially letting go of fear-based existence. Most of our existence, most of the time, is fear-based. And there's a possibility of letting go of that. It's pretty simple teaching. Pretty simple. And this is how I define fear. I didn't look it up, but you can look it up. How I define fear is an unpleasant feeling of perceived risk or danger, real or not. It functions to make us alert and ready for action while expecting specific problems. And so, Buddha's teaching was a way through fear. We can say a way out of fear, but you really have to go through it. That's his teaching, a way out of fear by going through fear. And that's what our practice is. And fear has an important function for the human species. Really, civilization was, if not wholly, at least partly developed because of fear. Fear of not enough food made us want to gather food. Fear of dangerous animals wanted to protect ourselves against dangerous animals. So each culture developed its own way of being based on what it perceived to be potentially annihilating. So that's the situation, isn't it? That's how cultures develop, how they maintain themselves, and then we defend ourselves against other humans who threaten our very existence. At least we think they threaten our very existence. So those fears are kind of the existential fears that keep cultures going, or you could say the dark side of what keeps cultures going. And then there are fears that are not quite so dramatic, but that are self-created because our mind self-creates them. Fear that I remember when my daughter first started going out late when she was like really young. Seemed to me much younger than I had gone out late. You know, fear that. I don't know, about all kinds of things when she wasn't home at 11:01, you know, 1 minute late. My wife and I both. Fears that newcomers upstairs, you know, they're doing this thing upstairs, which is introduction to Zen, just while you guys are sitting listening to me. Well, shall I come down to coffee and have coffee with you guys? Or say, shall I get out of here? Well, fear that maybe nobody will be nice to them. Maybe you'll be weird. all kinds of fears, right, that we carry around and that keep us alive but also keep us cut off, keep us isolated, and keep us often agitated. Not always, but often agitated when we need not be agitated, when there's really no threat. As it says in the trusting heart mind, we set up what we like against what we dislike, and that becomes the disease of the mind. So it becomes a disease for us. We get sick emotionally. From the Buddhist point of view, this is a universal phenomena. It's not just people who have diagnosable. It's universal. So the other day I was riding my bike. Here's an example. Here's an example of how fear operates. And this is not a negative example, actually. This is more a self-protective example. But since fear is always about something that hasn't happened, I was riding my bike, a guy cuts into me. Immediately my fear is that he's going to hit me. He does hit me. Then I have a new fear. Fear I'm going to fall. Then I fall. I have a new fear that I'm really going to be hurt. Then I feel, ow. Then I have a fear that maybe I won't be able to get home. And I don't have my... So that's how our fears happen, right? Like that. It's kind of an interesting phenomenon, isn't it? And it can be sort of distressing because then we are afraid that we'll experience nothing but fear, and or that we'll have few experiences that don't entail fear, so we have another layer of fear. So this is human condition that we're dealing with as Buddhist practitioners, as Buddhist meditators. And a lot of this is a pure imagination. It's pure. It serves a purpose to preserve the species, to preserve the family. But it is way out of control, don't you think? Way out of control. And then we have addictive fears too. I used to rock climb many, many years ago. Well, not long ago at all. I used to rock climb in Berkeley. Imagine or not, you don't think there are good rock climbing places in Berkeley, but there are lots of good rock climbing places. Well, the rush of adrenaline from rock climbing, from the fear that, you know, you get up there and you're halfway up, and the rush of adrenaline brings clarity. So I can remember being halfway up those rocks, and it was like samadhi. Really samadhi, total clarity, because the adrenaline rush and the need for survival really puts you into a deeply concentrated state, or you fall. So people get the same high they do out of meditation by doing bungee jumping and rock climbing and taking it to one level after another level after another level, so they can get that beginner's mind that we talk about in Zen, so they can come back and return to that. And the basic Buddhist teaching course is that most of the sphere isn't necessary, and that too often it makes us helpless. Are illogical projections, and most of them are illogical. A few, sometimes they aren't illogical. Like my fear that I'm going to fall off the bike when the guy hits me. That's not illogical, and that's probably a pretty healthy fear. But if you check them out, I bet that you'd find that, 71 to 82% were illogical? I don't know. Or 93% or something. They're illogical. They don't help. And they're projections. And when we get frozen in fear, then we feel hopeless. And we have clinical depression. That's a simple definition of clinical depression. Frozen in fear. And you don't even know it because you're just hopeless. And then we have phobias. Phobias where we think about the same spider over and over again until that spider turns into a monster, and then we're phobic about spiders. Strongly exaggerating the situation. But from the Buddhist point of view, we're always strongly exact, or 93% of the time, not 100%, 81% of the time, strongly exaggerating the situation. So, and fear is about basically not having control of the situation, not having a control, self being out of control. And of course, since Buddhism says the self is fictional, that's kind of ridiculous. But the self's also not fictional. You know, we have it with us from early childhood until we die. So yeah, it's fictional, but it's still always here, regardless of how many hours you sit or how many enlightenment experiences you have. Because it's built into our biology, into our evolution. So a little bit more on healthy fears. Healthy fear is the fears that drive us to come to Zen Center. It's the fear that drove Buddha to practice under the Bodhi tree. That's healthy fear. Wanting to achieve liberation from all this fear. Wanting to be able to just be with it calmly and not be overcome by it, not be dominated by it. So that's healthy fear. Wanting to have a different way of life. And fear of death is sometimes healthy fear too. If I'm driving a car and a car is swerving toward me, I should have some healthy fear. It would be good for me to get in that situation of being really alert, pumping that adrenaline up, and have healthy fear so I can swerve away. Because if I don't mobilize all my forces as that car is coming toward me, I ain't here anymore. And fear of bodily harm, of course, is on my bicycle. That's healthy fear. But most fear is unhealthy. It's about loss of poor Tim and everything he has, everything he knows, all his possessions, all his knowledge, all of his wisdom. You know, look at him, right? That ain't so healthy. It's not so healthy. Not so healthy. And religion is what about? It's about dealing with fear. You name it. Any kind of religion, it's about dealing with fear. Now, I probably shouldn't get into whether it's healthy or unhealthy, but a lot of it is unhealthy. I got into it. A lot of it is unhealthy. I've taught shamanism, but a lot of shamanism is about dealing with fear. Dealing with fear of the elements of a world you can't understand, so you develop relationships with spirits of the sun and the sky and stars that are going to help you, and those bad yucky spirits you keep away, and it's fear based, not entirely, but and then we have what? Theistic religion. Well, theistic religion isn't fear-based. What is? The fear of God, the fear of being without God, the fear of what God's going to do to me, the fear that I won't get to heaven, the projection into heaven, the projection of hells. If that's not fear-based, what is? And Buddhism. What about all this reincarnation stuff? Well, yeah, if I'm nice to you guys after talk, and I'm nice to my wife, maybe I'll be born in a better body than this one, or at least not an awful body. A lot of Buddhists always talking about karma and rebirth and how they're going to get their acts together. It's not too late to get your act together, so you'll be born in this or that way, and not in the other way. Fear. So we could do a whole series of talks on religion and fear, couldn't we? Our religion really doesn't help us with fear, is my point. religion just helps us sort of avoid fear and circumnavigate around fear, but doesn't really help us. Not with the central question of ego wanting to be separate, wanting to be good, wanting to be loved, and not feeling connected to the world. So the Dhammapada, which we are studying in our practice period, says, from what is dear, grief is born. From what is dear, fear is born. For someone freed from what is dear, there is no grief. So why fear? From what is love, grief is born. From what is loved, grief, fear is born. For someone freed from what is loved, there is no grief. So why fear? From craving, grief is born. From craving, fear is born. For someone freed from craving, there is no grief. So why fear? And trusting heart mind says, when the deep meaning of things is not understood, the mind's essential peace is disturbed to no avail. So now I'm going to talk about antidotes to fear from a Buddhist perspective, not from a therapeutic perspective. Somebody else can give that talk, a Western therapy. But there's a lot of overlap. So all of these antidotes are based on the premise that you have a sitting practice, that you have a meditation practice. They're all based on that. Because they're all based on the premise that when your mind is calm, when you're focused, that it's most likely you'll be able to deal with your fear. You're most likely you'll be able to pass through it and not be paralyzed by it or be freaked out by it. So the first antidote, tantric Buddhism, and I haven't done this one. Imagine the worst. So this is kind of like flooding. Imagine the worst. So tantric Buddhism, let's say you had a fear of spiders. So you would imagine in your sitting, in your meditation, you would have all the spiders come in. You would imagine them crawling over you, crawling in your sink, crawling all over, and then biting you. And then you would just keep your imagination going. Everything. You pull out every conceivable imagination. And according to the tantric Buddhists, and I believe it, that depotentiates. That depotentiates. But I haven't tried it yet. But I will if one of you guys will do it with me. Because it's kind of scary. I don't want to do it by myself. Don Corleone, remember Don Corleone in Godfathers? He says, you want to keep your friends close and your enemies closer. Tantric Buddhism. Exactly, precisely. Antidote 2, understanding karma. Oh, karma. A lot of this fear is because of stuff we did in the past. Things we did that created this paranoia about our life and about others. And if we can begin to plant some good seeds, see that bad karma we created, we can let go of the fear. The caveat is that in Buddhism, karma is... some of the fear that we have isn't due to our own karma. Because stuff just got light on us. Remember, in Buddhism, for karma to really work, you have to have an attention. And if you don't have if you're born into a family where your mother is abusive and your father is not there for you, that you're not creating bad karma. In the Hindu sense, you created bad karma, but not in the Buddhist sense, because it's about intention. The second step on the path, intention. So that would be the caveat for that one. The third one is Tonglen. Tonglen. Imagine taking the fear of another person, the fear that I have of you, taking that fear in. Taking that fear in. Just completely taking it in and then giving you good vibes. So whatever I'm scared about with you, you're kind of a big guy and you look kind of tough and and I'm scared because, I don't know, maybe I'm a little guy and I'm not tough. I'm scared. But I take that fear in. I just take it in completely. And then I give you good vibes. Tonglen. And people have been teaching that here. Rosemary had a couple classes on it. Tonglen. It's good. I've done it over the years and it works. It doesn't work in every situation, but it works. Fourth antidote. See what you're suppressing. And this is based on having a meditation practice. See what's coming up. See what's surrounding that fear, what the fear is saying to you, how it's feeling physiologically, what the associated feelings and thoughts are. See it. Pull out everything. But pull it out just by sitting with it, not by messing with it. Just by sitting with it. So here's a Zen Buddhist who wrote this. Once I did this, he's talking about antidote four. Once I did this in Zazen and saw the result, I started searching for my mind for the really horrible repressed memories related to that fear, the kind that make you twitch when even a glimmer of them would begin to show. If you start seeing a little memory coming to the surface in your meditation, even when you aren't prepared, this is a little bit maybe more proactive than I would do it, but this is what he said, grab it and yank it out and bring the roots with it. Be the one allowing it to come to the surface. Look right at it. Explore all the aspects of it that you were always afraid of. So that's good. That's good. And in our Zen, we don't emphasize looking for that kind of thing. But if you sit a lot of retreats, that'll come up sometimes. If it never comes up, if you sit retreat after retreat and never comes up, then you probably should come talk to me. Maybe I'll help you a little bit. It's possible. It's scary. Oh, is that what I should do? I don't know, but it will come up. And for me, I've talked about this before, in my early years of sitting, maybe only my first year, I was really a good guy. I went around going like this all the time, and I was really trying to practice so hard that I was a little bit inauthentic, but that's okay. When you try to do something hard, you really try to do something, change, you want to ignore that other stuff. So I wanted to ignore that other stuff. I remember people saying, boy, he is really devoted. But inside, I'm a very competitive person. I come from a very competitive family in a competitive part of the country. Went to competitive schools and, all that stuff. A lineage of competitiveness, a male lineage of competitiveness. So that stuff was under there. And I can remember, even with my wife, I think she wishes we still had those days, but even with my wife, I let everything go. I just gosh-o'd and... But I wasn't really letting it go, I was trying to be good. And I was trying to keep down the fear. Because my competitiveness came from fear. It does. That's just what we're saying. Survival of the species. Survival of Tim. So then that stuff began coming up in my meditation. And I began seeing, I want to be the best sitter in the room. That's why I'm doing extra gosh-o-ing. And it wasn't that I even was conscious of trying to impress people. I wasn't even doing that. It was all an internal thing. So I began to see my aggression and my fear, and began to just watch it. Just watch it and be with it and acknowledge it. antidote number five. Acceptance. Suzuki Roshi, my root teacher. Acceptance, 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 acceptance. It's everything he taught. Everything he taught. Not stoicism. Stoicism's not acceptance. It's doing something in your head. Saying something to yourself. This is just pure and unadulterated acceptance. This is what is. This is what is. This sleepiness, this boredom, these sexual desires, this is what is. Period. Acceptance, 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 acceptance. The presence of fear means only that fear is present. Acceptance, 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 acceptance. Nothing more. Nothing less. So, Pema Chodron says, usually we think that brave people have no fear. The truth is that they are intimate with fear. When I was first married, my husband said I was one of the bravest people he knew. When I asked him why, he said, because I was a complete coward, but went ahead and did things anyhow. Things can and will go wrong forever in your life. Things can and will go wrong. Acceptance. Last time I talked about the Taoist teaching that we should embrace King Chaos. That nobody wants to embrace King Chaos. They want to hang out with the other two kings, but not King Chaos. And I talked about Trungpa Rinpoche seeing chaos as extremely good news. And we create fear, so we can uncreate it. We can uncreate it. It's a habit. Fear is a habit. Any habit can be broken. Any habit can be broken. But trying to break it consciously may not be the best way. It may be better to practice meditation and do these antidotes that come out of meditation. I can't say that for sure, though. I can't say that for sure. And therapy might be good sometime, too. Cognitive behavioral therapy. And some of this is cognitive behavioral therapy, but it's much older. Much older. And I guess if you get credit for being older, I don't know, probably not. Antidote 6, actively provoke your fear. Instead of feeling helpless, you confront it. If you're afraid of losing something, give it away. Give it away. If you're afraid of high places, go to a high place. If you're afraid of speaking in public, speak in public. Speak in public. It's called in Zen taking one step off the top of the 100-foot pole. Taking one step off the top of the 100-foot pole. And what frightens us most, as I said before, is the thought of being afraid. That's what frightens us most. Mark Twain says, do the thing you fear most, and the death of fear is certain. Oh. Do the thing you fear most, and the death of fear is certain. So I've talked about my father a lot. So much that it's a little bit embarrassing, but not so embarrassing that I'm not going to talk about him again today. Sorry, Dad. Look at all the opportunities you created for me. last time and other times I've talked about, I moved to Minnesota with my young family. And I didn't know at the time, but later I realized that I moved to get away from my parental family. And actually, Linda and I both realized that we moved here to get away from both of our parental families, although we had no idea we were doing it at the time. No idea. The only reason I realized that after we've been here about 5 years, you know, this repressed stuff is quite incredible. Zazen or no Zazen. And my father, who totally rejected me, wouldn't speak with me, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, because I was the good kid who'd become the bad kid. If I'd not been a good kid in the first place, I would have been okay. I'd made a big mistake by starting out as a good kid. I had told my grandson that the other day when I was hanging out with him. He said, don't be too good, you know. Don't, Ethan, just, you know, mess up a little bit. You know, your parent, I'm kind of kidding, but not exactly. Not exactly. So, you know, I totally rejected by my dad. Totally put down, devalued, everything. So, here I was. And I just started doing this antidote of calling him on the phone. Would he listen to me? Would he talk? My stepmother would say, he's available. No, I'm not available. Then he'd get talk for maybe 2 minutes, and then he'd hang up. Just kept trying it. Went out to California. Would he see me? I took my little children. Would he see me? Invited to Minnesota. Only came to Minnesota once. I guess you guys, I told this probably before six times. He would come at the airport and on his way to some exotic place, right? And he would never leave the Minnesota airport. I had to go visit him at the airport. And that was after I had really worked on this for years. But ultimately, we had a reconciliation. We had a reconciliation. And I was scared shitless. In the early times, I kept reaching out, and I got no reinforcement. All I had was my cushion. That was my reinforcement, and my teacher, and my sangha. That's all I had. We don't have much. We won't get much. But if we extend ourselves, I think it's amazing what can happen. It's amazing if we do it without expectation. Because as soon as we create more expectation, there's more fear. But I had to give up all expectation. He was the way he was behaving. So, that's my lesson. One of my lessons for today. And I feel like I just sort of made it by the skin of my teeth. He just came around, you know, a few years before he died. And then it felt really good. It felt really good. All those years of putting myself out, not knowing, being scared. And then at the end, yeah, no fear. Antidote 7, realization of trusting heart-mind. Okay? So-called awakening or enlightenment or living an enlightened life or living an awake life. Realization of trusting heart-mind. That's the center of being. Center of being is not Tim, is not Rosemary, is not Darren. Center of being is trusting heart mind. And it's the nature of heart mind to trust. That's just what it does. It doesn't know anything else. Shin is the term, the character in the Heart Sutra. Shin just doesn't know anything else. So last time I was talking about Hui Ko, who was Sungsan. Sungsan wrote this. Hui Ko was his teacher. Bodhidharma was Hui Ko's teacher. Hui Ko went to Bodhidharma and he'd been practicing his zazen really hard, but he was still having lots of fear come up. And he said to Bodhidharma, please calm my mind so I don't have this fear. And Bodhidharma said, show me where your mind is. And he went back and meditated, Hui Ko, for another week, 2 weeks, sitting in retreats. And then he had an experience of letting go of Hui Ko. Only there was nobody to let go of Hui Ko. Hui Ko was seen through, completely seen through. And he came back to Bodhidharma and said, ungraspable, unattainable, unknowable. And with deep peace and trusting in heart mind. And the last antidote, and there's no special order to these antidotes, The last antidote is repeating something to yourself when you're faced by fear. Repeating something to yourself. Peace is my natural state of mind. Or peace is here. For some reason, I got in my head when I was young, even though I didn't do Christianity. I read some stuff about Jesus as peace that passes understanding. And that's what I used. I remember for almost a whole year, my first year of doing Zen, actually, I didn't do Zen. I did that. I mean, I sat in Zen, but that's what I would do when I'd be scared. So, one last story, and then I'll be finished. Story which I probably told before, but I'm not sure. This is about this last antidote, about repeating something to yourself at a time when you're fearful. Repeating something from a scripture or from something that reminds you that fear is just in your imagination, that fear just is a self-creation. Something to remind you of that. So, I've always been fond of this trusting heart mind. It's probably been one of my favorite sutras for many years. And I always liked the one, the phrase in it, hold no opinions for or against. No opinions for or against. So a couple of years ago, let's see, I try to talk about this story without going on and on. The last 3 years, about the last 3 years, I spent a lot of time at the legislature in the Capitol in the spring because I direct a nonprofit for people with mental illness, and our funding gets jeopardized sometimes. Well, 3 years in a row, the governor has eliminated or proposed eliminating funding for our homeless programs. These are people who live outdoors with schizophrenia, bipolar disorders, anxiety disorders, serious and persistent depression. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine that we allow that to happen here in this most affluent part of the world where everybody has so much? Can you imagine that? Anyway, we do that. And we're all responsible for that. Anyway, 3 years in a row, the governor was going to eliminate the fund. He said, oh, there's other programs like this that just eliminate this funding. So bringing homeless people with mental illness indoors and giving them a 24/7 support. So I'm there every year. I mean, not that I want to be, but it's my job. You know. And session before last. What's happened every year in the last 3 years, and I'm going to knock on wood because there's a next year's going to be worse, right? So I'm knocking doubly on wood here. is that the governor eliminates the funding, and then I go to the legislature, and they put it back in. And so, not this last year, but the year before, the legislature put it back in, and then it was veto time at the governor's desk. You guys remember that? Maybe you don't follow these things. He was going to veto a whole bunch of funding. So by this time, you know, I'm not having very fond feelings about the government, right? I mean, forget my political persuasion. Forget that. I mean, that's something in itself, but forget that. I have no opinions for or against. My goodness. I'm seething. And I'm also crying inside because I don't want to put these... I'll be responsible for these people going back out on the streets. I'll feel responsible, even though we're all responsible. So I'm seething. And I figure out how to through just a lot of different behaviors and friends with a couple of wealthy Republicans, very wealthy Republicans, I figure out how to get an audience with the governor's chief of staff. The governor's chief of staff has been very rude to me, said, of course, it's going to be eliminated. It's superfluous. We can't afford this kind of thing, Dr. Burkett. I said, call me Tim. He won't call me Tim. He only calls me Dr. Burkett. We can't afford this kind of thing. This is a waste of the taxpayers' money. These people can just go into shelter, da 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 da. So, not friendly, very unfriendly. So I'm not exactly having, being free from opinions about this guy. But then we get an audience with him. My wealthy friends, we get in to see him. Not the governor, but the chief of staff, and my friends write letters to the governor, which then I harass the chief of staff until the governor has read them, because the chief of staff first says, oh yeah, he's read them. And I keep calling back to make sure he's read them. So by that time, talk about my competitiveness, you know. So we have an audience with him, and like I know we're going to get like about 8 minutes with him. He says he has no time to see us, but he's going to fit us in between four appointments that he has, four 15-minute appointments during between 10 and 11 a.m., right? So I practice. Here I am doing my Zen meditation in the morning, and then after that, for 2 hours, no opinions, for or against. That's my mantra. No opinions, for or against. And I'm staying with that mantra. I'm staying with that. I only have to do it for 2 hours. And then when I walk in and I see the guy, I don't have any opinion for or against. I'm just there. So, and then of course we get the money. And what the guy says is, but it's not because of me, it's because of my wealthy Republican friends. He says, oh, the governor thinks these are two of the most thrifty, important programs in the state. That's what he says, after having not said, you know, just dissed me time after time. But anyway, even then, I'm just there, no opinions, just happy to be there. Until later, you know, because always something else is coming up. But that's why we use these. That's why we have all these teachings. We can use any of them at any time. We have a huge toolbox of teachings we can pull out. Into this vast space where nothing is lacking and nothing in excess. There's a huge toolbox in this vast space of things that we can pull out to settle into our fear, to see that our fear is imaginary, and to just be free of it. Be free of it. So that's what I'd like to say for today. Questions, comments? Yeah. Right.
Earlier in your talk, I referenced to fear. You said something about the basic Buddhist idea, the fiction of the self.
Yeah.
Versus the what you're doing, what is inherent, biological, belief in self, or.
Well, I didn't say. I don't know if I said biological, but it almost seems biological, doesn't it? And it's this whole thing about we have to individuate, we have to develop ego. Is that biological? Yeah, I would say that is biological, isn't it? That is biological. I agree. I don't know if I said it, but I agree.
Could you comment on that a little bit more as far as the Buddhist idea is basically that reification, solidification of self is something that we need to
Well, and I've just been talking about how it's destructive. I've been talking about how it's destructive to always be wringing our hands in this little self and to actually believe that this little self has any control over anything and really exists independently at all. But at the same time, Buddha said, I don't say that there is no self. And he might have said, if I were there, I would have said, I am presumptuous enough to say that we need a self. We need a self with good boundaries, with a sense of permeable boundaries, but not too rigid boundaries, to survive, to have goals, to move toward those goals, to deal with interpersonal relationships. Most of therapy is about developing a healthy self, a healthy but flexible ego. But the more healthy our ego comes, the more flexible it is, the more potentially permeable it is, permeable without being boundaryless. And the more permeable ego becomes, the more it can realize that it's just a fiction. A necessary fiction. A very necessary fiction for our survival. Does that...
It's kind of like a way of dealing with conventional...
Yes. Yes, the and also, but the conventional world gets put down too much in Buddhism.
Right.
The conventional world is what is.
Right.
I mean, we say unconventional world is the deep world or the absolute, but the conventional world is what is. So, that let's not disparage it.
Yeah, it's not like much of a
right.
Ultimate.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Anybody else?
What would you say about the relationship between fear and craving? Craving being one of the four noble truths.
Oh, yeah. Big relationship. Yeah, big relationship. Big relationship. When we break down the first noble truth, which is about suffering, but it's not about physical suffering. Because we all physically suffer. It's about suffering due to the second noble truth, which is craving. We divide the world up, and our fear is about not getting those things to keep us filled, so that we feel okay about ourselves. We crave being filled. I crave having more of you. Pay attention to me while I'm talking. You know, sleepiness. Oh, how could you do that to me? You know, we personalize. We personalize, don't we? We all personalize. That's the craving. That's the craving. My talk. Everybody, et cetera, et cetera. On and on and on. Human condition. Think I'm different? Nobody's different from it. Yasutani Roshi said, we all belong to the same nose hole society. That's the first talk I heard him give on Zen. That's all he walked in. He said, we all belong to the same nose hole society. And then he walked out. Craving, yeah. Yeah, so craving and fear exactly are pairs. They're paired. But I don't know if I dealt with your question.
Well, I just think it's interesting because it seems like fear is... this is an arbitrary way to talk about it. Fear is kind of below craving. And so
below craving, yeah.
It's just interesting that you're talking about fear, which you're kind of saying is based on delusion. We're self-creating.
Yeah.
And so to deal with craving seems kind of a strange way of going about it.
Yeah, I think fear is underlying it. Fear is underlying it. Yeah, I think we need to revise Buddhist teaching. Well, it's always everybody's always revising everything. We don't know what Buddhist teaching is anymore, right? Anything else?
Yeah.
Sure.
How do you know that karma works?
How do you know that it works?
That it is.
That it is. That it is what?
That it's a principle of the universe.
Oh, well, we just know that causes have effects. I know that when I poke you, you go ow. So that's all. Maybe you mean something more than that. We know that everything we do has an effect. Every cause has an effect. Every cause has an effect, and every effect has a cause. Cause, effect, cause, effect, cause, effect. Simultaneously and temporally, forever. Does that...
That makes sense, yeah. I mean, I understand that.
Okay. Okay. Yeah?
something just to add to that, that in the introduction to the Dhammapada, it says that when we habitually do things, it cuts kind of a groove in our consciousness.
Hmm.
So that's where it makes more sense with karma, where it's like it's baggage that we carry. Because it becomes habitual.
Yeah, yeah, good. Yep, yeah. Yep. Yeah. So much of our karma is habitual. Yep. Yeah.